Case number 84148, Martinez versus Martinez. Are the parties ready to proceed?
We are. Yes, Your
Honor. Okay, great. All right, Mr. Willick, why don't you come on up and tell me if you would like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I would. 5 minutes, please.
Okay, so just a reminder that we have been on the en banc arguments. We added on an additional 2 minutes for each side, and it's the initial 2 minutes uninterrupted at the beginning of each side's argument. So that's your time to say what you would like to say without interruption. But so the 17-minute clock will be running down. And I'm sorry, I already forgot how much time you said you wanted to reserve.
Five, please.
5 minutes, so when it gets down to five, you'll get the yellow light and the tone, but the clock keeps running. You know how this works. Go ahead.
Thank you. Madam Chief Justice, Justices, Marshall Willick for Jennifer Martinez. May it please the Court. This Court's posted summary lists three issues, essentially whether NAC 425-150 must be followed in allocating transportation costs, whether a court is prohibited from substituting its own default schedule from one agreed to by the parents without finding that agreement unconscionable, illegal, or in violation of public policy, and whether the total absence of evidence for findings and orders calls for reversal of those orders. The answer to all three of those questions is yes. First, unequal allocation of travel expenses is defined as an adjustment of child support on the face of the regulations. A court may take the cost of transportation into effect in altering how much money changes hands between parents for child support, but if the court does so, it's obligated by the regulations to find out and to make written findings of the specific needs of the child and the economic circumstances of the parents. A few weeks ago, the Child Support Commission started the process of clarifying its regulations to state that any changes in money changing hands between parents for child support, including for child care or medical costs, is an adjustment of child support requiring written findings. That's why the regulations will now and in the future set out language clarifying the difference between guideline-based support and final total child support. And that's the way the regulations will be structured. Now, this court last year declared that it reviews agency regulations with deference, stating that an agency regulation is reviewed for whether it violates statutory or constitutional provisions or whether it exceeds the agency's statutory authority. The regulations in question here are squarely within the Child Support Commission's mandate. As noted by Amicus Family Law Section, NAC 425-151E inextricably links child support to travel costs and requires findings as to the adjustment factors listed. Under the regs, any order that causes a significant and recurring child-related expense to be borne unequally is an adjustment of the base child support amount. It must be consistent with the child's specific needs and the economic circumstances of the parties, including the total household income and who is paying what other child support expenses. This court did not hold differently in Maculuk. This court held that where the district court has already ordered an obligor to pay the entirety of medical and other costs, it can't again order increased child support because of those same expenses. That holding isn't relevant here. Those facts are not the same. And it was a McMonagle violation to base the order for the payment of those fees on the basis of a repealed statute and a relocation that was made 6 years and five child support orders previously. Deference is simply not owed, as this court has repeatedly held, to legal error or to findings so conclusory they mask legal error. Second, these parties explicitly agreed that it was in the best interest of their child to have all 3-day weekend visitations in Las Vegas, and they explicitly agreed on the length of the summer visitation. They had one minor dispute. There are several reasons it was error for the district court to substitute its default schedule to the one agreed to by the parents without finding their agreement to be unconscionable, illegal, or contrary to public policy. First, once a court has found, as this court did, that there's been no substantial change in circumstances, it simply has no room to impose a substitute custody schedule under Romano. Second, this court has declared the parental agreements on custodial timeshares are presumed to be in the best interest of a child. Overcoming that presumption requires both facts that run contrary to it.
Mr. Willick, though, in the situation, doesn't Dabb dispute that there was an agreement?
I don't see how he can. It's in his own counsel's trial memo as his preferred schedule, and there was examination at the court of Mom's point-by-point-by-point agreement by opposing counsel to Mom, agreeing to every single point. So the actual agreement was declared in open court. It's both in the writing and in the testimony. So
didn't your client also seek deviation from that? If we were to hold that there was an agreement, find that there was an agreement, didn't your client also seek a modification of that by requesting supervised visitations?
No. The only point of dispute was whether there should be a break in Dad's 7 weeks. Dad said no, Mom said yes. She wanted a break to break it in half. The supervised visitation was not a request of modification. She requested a psychoneurological evaluation and said that because there were questions raised as to Dad's capacity, she wanted supervision until that examination was completed. Remember that Dad walked into court and said, oh, you don't need to order me to do the evaluation because I already did it. Which is when the judge said, well, then produce the existing report and we're done. But in fact, there was no examination, there was no report. It was a copy of a 5-year-old letter, which was 2 auto accidents and concussions previous. So Dad's condition had nothing to do at the time of this evidentiary hearing with his condition at the time that that letter from one of the 3 doctors had been written. And all 3 of those doctors said that a neuropsychological evaluation was required for the protection of the child, plus the child custody evaluator. So we have 4 professionals, all of whom said that a neuropsychological evaluation was required, which is why Mom wanted it. And the only reason it wasn't ordered by an IME is because Dad lied and said that he had just done one.
To Justice Bell's point, what are you stating is the actual agreement between the parties? I note that there's a 2019 order which wasn't included in the record, and then there's a 2017 order. What are you saying?
It's the pre-existing child custody terms, which included that all 3-day visits occur in Las Vegas, because the parents both concluded that the child reacted very badly to having those visits in California.
Is that the 2017 order?
2017, repeated in the filings in 2018 and 19, and repeated again by Dad in his Exhibit C, which was his proposed visitation schedule, to which Mom specifically agreed. So we've got the agreement repeated several times, both by agreement and by court order, but it just didn't go forward. And these agreements are presumed to be in the best interest of the child. The district court judge was operating on feelings. It's sad, I'm concerned, but feelings are not findings.
Mr. Willick, can I inquire as to the travel situation? Wasn't there initially an order that was part of the custody order that it'd be 50-50 and that the court's change is related to Jennifer's insistence that it be flight instead of driving? Because I couldn't quite tell. It was the court ordering that all of the transportation has to be borne by Jennifer, or was the court ordering if Jennifer insists on travel by air, then Jennifer's going to have to pay for it?
I don't remember that condition. I can't quote you the exact language, but it's in the filings. It just simply said, because Mom moved, all transportation will be at her expense and she will fly. Well, she left that to Dad.
Well, it said, to follow up on Justice Stiglitz's question, it said, since it was Mom who moved away from California to Nevada, she'll be responsible for the costs of travel, depending on if the parties agree to fly or drive
right.
the child.
Because if they had been meeting in Victorville,
right.
But she left that choice to Dad, and of course Dad says, well, if she's footing the bill, then fly. So Mom, the dollars aren't in the order because they hadn't occurred yet, but the total expense of all those extra 3-day weekend flights completely consumes all the child support. There's no child support being paid, which is why the economic conditions of the party should have been reflected in the order, because if the court had seen that, perhaps the order would be different. There is essentially no child support being paid for the last couple of years because the entirety of the cost is consumed with these additional travel costs imposed on Mom. And Mom makes less than Dad. And Dad has never even revealed what his current spouse's income is. It's not on any 3 of his FDFs. So the total economic circumstances of the parties has never even been presented to the district court, nevertheless weighed, considered, and findings made based on it, which is why we're saying that those things are required and asking for a reversal and a remand on that basis, because the economics are just horrible for people in this economic situation. I mean, look, this court explained in Grisham that agreements are to be upheld, and parents either do have the right to reach these agreements or they don't. If they do, then the order throwing out that agreement and substituting a completely different schedule with completely different expenses should be reversed on that basis. And if the core parties don't have the ability to make such agreements and have them actually upheld by the courts, absent a finding that they're illegal, unconscionable, or contrary to public policy.
But, counsel, this isn't an agreement situation. The parties were disputing a lot of different things, which is why the court was having the evidentiary hearing
to start with. Not a lot of different things. The existing schedule had one dispute in it, whether or not Dad's summer visitation should be broken. Dad had asked for a finding that the situation was completely different and therefore that custody should change. And she threw that out. The court specifically found there's been no material change of circumstances affecting the welfare of the child, and so there's no change of circumstance. So the custody action was off to the side. The only thing that was remaining was Mom's request for the neuropsychological evaluation to detect Dad's capacity to parent the child, supervision until that evaluation was complete, and whether or not there'd be a break in the summer. Those were the only disputes.
So because of those issues, the court heard evidence regarding what had been happening regarding visitation, what Mom's abilities were and what Dad's abilities were and how they were relating with the child, right?
Well, you could say that. The court did entertain testimony, but all of the documentary evidence that exists is contrary to the findings that were made, which is why we have basically, the reason we're complaining about an anastasis violation is that there was no, courts just can't be permitted to award relief outside the scope of what either side is requesting without getting some advance notice that that's on the table. Because if you do, you don't, if you allow that, you don't have notice and an opportunity to be heard because there's no possibility of preparation. You can't prepare for something that nobody's asked for. And that's what this judge did. She simply imposed a completely different schedule and responsibility than anything that anybody had asked for. And that deprived Mom of an opportunity to prepare or present. And then that brings us back to the neuropsychological evaluation. By saying repeatedly that it had to be there because Dad's capacity was a critical item, and then 3 days before the hearing saying, well, okay, it doesn't exist, but we're going forward anyway, Mom had no ability to present a case because the evidence that she needed didn't exist because Dad lied. Now, if that had been revealed far earlier, she could have requested it at IME and had that evaluation done. But the court simply disregarded its prior order that when Dad lied and said he had done a full evaluation and ordered him to present the report, didn't go forward. I see that my time is up.
You want to reserve the rest of your time?
Hmm?
Do you want to reserve the rest of your time?
I'll take one more minute and then I'll go, because I do want to say something about the third issue. The third issue as to evidence is that in order to have conflicting evidence, there has to be some evidence. You can't just recite factors and claim that you're weighing them if the record itself doesn't show. The facts that the district court referenced in making the findings that it did simply don't exist. There is not a single instance, not one in this record, that anybody can point to where Mom ever scheduled any child event on Dad's time. It doesn't exist. Mom never made a single call to CPS in Nevada. Prior domestic violence can't be inapplicable if there is a criminal conviction of a party for domestic violence in the record. Yet this district court found that it was an inapplicable factor. This court has held that a criminal conviction is clear and convincing evidence as a matter of course of domestic violence and relevant. The trial transcripts include Dad reading out loud the driver's license restriction that the district court judge says doesn't exist.
The transcript does not clearly show that there's a restriction.
He reads it. I've got it right here quoted. It's in the filings. I can't quote it from memory, but it's quoted in the original fast track statement that exactly what Dad read into the record. It says, first he says there isn't one, and then he says, oh, I'm sorry, correction. It says contact DMV for specific restrictions. And that's in the transcript. So you can't be denied that it exists.
So what are the restrictions?
What?
So what are the restrictions he has?
He never said.
Well, right. So there's nothing in the record that shows restrictions,
no,
right?
No, no. There's a record that there are restrictions. We don't know what the specific restrictions are because that knowledge was only in Dad's possession and his attorney didn't ask him to recite it. The point is that there's a bunch of false facts in the finding.
No one asked him to recite it.
No, it was his attorney asking the questions at that moment. Mom didn't have the information. How could she? It only existed on the back of Dad's driver's license, and Dad was the only one in possession of the information. My point is that even if there had been a substantial change of circumstances, and this court, the district court found that there wasn't,
right,
we're back to feelings not being facts. There's no conflicting evidence. So it's an ALBA violation to say that I'm weighing the evidence and it comes out on one side when there is no contradictory evidence to the facts I just recited, amongst others. There's about a half a dozen or a dozen of those. And the Court of Appeals are simply wrong. It's not a matter of asking that these things be reweighed. This is an emperor's clothes situation. Those facts simply don't exist. So I'll say one more thing and then I'll reserve. It brings us back to the McMonagle situation. This court said in McMonagle that facts preceding the last custody order are inadmissible to change a custody order. And then this court said in Nance that those facts are admissible in order to not change. They can be used defensively only. But the district court got it exactly backwards in both directions. It recited a marginal old fact as one of its factors to alter custody and ignored all the prior facts that are at odds with its intent to change custody. The court should stress, if it wants to uphold Nance, that pre-prior order facts can only be used defensively. And I'd like to reserve the last little bit of time I have.
Madam Chief Justice, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Melvin Grimes. I'm the attorney for Paul Martinez. I would like to end my this by pointing out to you a very important fact that has circulated this case for now 9 years in California and now Nevada. As we stand here today under the custody order, the minor child should be in California with her dad. She has once again been withheld for time with dad. He has not seen her since Christmas. That is a continuing and ongoing event that has occurred with Ms. Martinez, and she will not stop. And she brought this to Nevada for forum shopping. I have been involved in this case from the start. I was actually ordered to appear by Judge Regali in California. Granted, you let me do it by video. Because of the gamesmanship, as he outlined in that order. So, let's talk about the change of circumstances. The change of circumstance, I had a burden to prove to change custody. That was denied at the motion hearing. I included that motion hearing transcript with my supplemental appendix. You can review it. The judge denied it. That was not up for trial. What was up for trial was the order from California issued in 2018. The parties were ordered to mediation and back to court if they could not reach a agreement. And that agreement was to take into account her entering school. I apologize for not including that in my supplement. I can make it available to the court. I assumed, because I looked at the overview, that it was in the appendix. Inexplicably, it is missing, as I believe Justice Kadish pointed out. It's not there, but it exists. And it ordered them to redo it when she entered kindergarten. And she wanted to avoid that. There was no Anastasios error because there was no agreement. There wasn't an agreement on anything. The three-day weekends, we were willing to come here, but there was an issue, and this came out in trial, and it's in the transcripts. And while if I believed this was going to go on appeal and I was specifically told it was not, I would have ensured that that part of the transcript was included in the findings of facts and conclusions of law. But the court expressed real concern because Paul was traveling here. He was supposed to present his gas receipts and she was to reimburse him. At that time, in the 7 years they had been doing this, She had never refunded a single dime. She refused. That is important to understand because that is why First Judge Regali changed it to Victorville, because now we don't have to exchange money. But the three-day weekends, he couldn't exercise as many of them because she wouldn't reimburse. So, Justice Stiglitz, you raised the issue of, wasn't this just about the airplane travel? Yes, that's all it was. And they said that they left that up to Paul. They didn't. They left it up to the parents. And Paul has expressed from the beginning, I can drive there. He didn't care. He just wants to see his daughter.
To the point of the question that Justice Stiglitz asked earlier, let me expand on this, because my sense of the court's order is the court made efforts on various occasions to say, Mom does not want a co-parent. Mom is consistently interfering with Dad's custodial time. Mom's consistently engaging in controlling behavior. Mom is borderline alienation. And so then we have a finding of Mom moved from California to Nevada, so you're going to pay the travel costs depending on if the parties agree to fly or drive the child. That specific order seemed to me to be less about relocation and more about Mom doesn't want to do anything or agree to anything, so if Mom can't reasonably talk about mode of travel, then you're going to have to pay for the whole cost.
And I have an advantage over Mr. Willick in this, in that I was there in the trial.
Okay.
It is my firm belief that the intent of the judge was, look, Mom, if you want to do this airplane thing, and again, you have to go back and read the entire transcript, there was an incident with the other flight where Paul said, fine, let's go here, Burbank Airport, it's cheaper.
But Mr. Grimes, that's not what's in the order, right?
No, ma'am.
That's what we review is what's in the order.
I understand.
And so in how can a court separate out one particular category under 425.150? Wouldn't that just completely eliminate the purpose of having child support guidelines if the court can just say, I'm going to order this separately and then look at the rest of these factors in determining child support?
I appreciate that question. And this court about a year ago in that Lutuck said we can pull out child care, which is mandatory under 425.130. We can pull out child's health insurance. That's mandatory, again, in the calculation of child support under 140.
But both of those have a separate regulation that requires the court to enter those items, so that makes some sense, right?
It makes sense, but they're mandatory to be addressed, and this court said you can pull mandatory out. You can pull that out and not calculate that with the child support.
But those aren't specific items under 150. Those have their own separate regulations.
That is correct. Okay. 150, though, are permissive as opposed to mandatory. It doesn't hold logic that you can pull out a mandatory but not pull out a permissive and address it separately. So my position there, and I wish I had presented it better in my brief.
That wasn't really the issue in Matt. Look, I'm going to butcher that. Was it? Because it was the issue there was the double counting of the money. That the issue wasn't before the court of do these qualify as expenses that should be considered under the child support calculation or not. It was that the court had counted them twice.
No. In that case, the court permitted them to pull out the two mandatories and to address them separately and said that was acceptable. What the court said was not acceptable is applying the 150 and going beyond the cap that is contained under the other provisions. And the court said the cap is exactly what the statute says, which is the up to the amount of the payee's obligation. That was the limit of the cap under the statute. And so it limited how much further they could deviate. My position here, as we apply it to this case, is, in reading Mr. Willick's brief, I actually kind of agree with him. We need some clarification on this. If we can pull out mandatories, we certainly can pull out permissives. And if we can't pull out permissives, then we never should have been allowed to pick out mandatories. So they should, we should either go strictly by it, which it sounds like.
And I'm sorry, maybe I missed something.
Okay.
Where are you saying, or in what case are you saying that we held you can pull out mandatories?
In the Matlatuck.
You're talking about the Matkalek.
In the Matlatuck, this court permitted them to address them separately and apply all of them to that.
It wasn't challenged.
But the regulatory scheme also suggests that there would be a decision about medical support, there would be a decision about child care, then there is the child support amount, and then there are the exceptions to the deviations to the child support amount, right? So at least the way that the regulations are currently structured, it suggests that the court would make independent decisions about those two things, make a child support determination, and then look to any modifications, right?
The strict reading, I would respectfully disagree. The strict reading of it is that we would apply a deviation for the health insurance as to the child support. We would apply mandatorily apply a deviation for the child care, and then permissively apply the following six deviations and the court has to make findings based on that.
Point me to specific language in the regulations that supports your position.
The fact that at 130 it says the court must, and this is all in the calculation of child support under 125 or 425. 425-130 child care adjustments are mandatory. 425-135 a health insurance address is mandatory, and then transportation falls under the 150. It's actually the E, and it is permissive. The court is not required to address that. So that those are what I'm specifically addressing to. Then applying the way you, and again, Justice Kavish brought up the point it wasn't contested, and so maybe that wasn't part of the appeal. I read the holding. That was the way I read the holding, was that the court was permitting those mandatories to be removed. Okay? And if a mandatory can be removed, clearly I would feel like logic says a permissive can be removed. In this case, the court was trying to eliminate the fighting. Mom wanted to play games with, so you want to fly, buy the tickets. You don't want to fly, meet in Victorville. And that is still the order, and that's not a change.
But even if the court had a reason to order mom to pay all of the travel expenses, didn't the court need to make findings other than mom was the one who moved?
Under the strict reading, I would agree with the court. Okay, the court would need to make sufficient findings to support that, or to clarify that it is only because mom is requesting the plane ticket. I can say that because I was there, I think that was the intent of the court. But if this court says that the court below needs to make clear findings regarding that, I think a finding that simply says that because mom is therefore expressing that she only wants the child to fly and not to be driving, I think that would be adequate to meet the requirements under the current administrative code. So I would ask the court that if that is the only issue here, that falls into, frankly, harmless error. But now, much has been made of this neural report. And again, I filed it in a supplemental appellate appendix. I will point out they filed the entire medical report in the confidential appendix 14. It includes the neural report. It's not a neuropsych, but it's a neurologist, and it's every 2 years. And that information was all made available both to Dr. Smith and to the court in California. They were well aware of it. Okay? Them saying that they got one photo, that's incorrect. We provided what we had, which was the original order. The request for a neurologic exam was denied. Okay? It wasn't, oh, well, it's denied because you said it was just done. Okay? They were making further argument. I pointed out, we only have some of the medical records. That was done, and then I don't hear from them. And the judge was clear, and again, I included the transcript. Request them. Mr. Grimes, if he requests them, turn them over. Okay, we did. That was insufficient. So then, on the last day of discovery, he files a request for production of documents of all medical records. I filed a motion for a protective order. I cited to the findings of the court that you had already blocked the neurologic report. Judge Forsberg, frankly, got it right. I tried. But she got it right. She said, no, health and the medical, mental and medical, physical health of a parent is one of the best interest factors. That's fair game, and I don't care that it was one day before. We'll move the trial, but get, you have until this date to get those records. We didn't just get the neurologic. We went, and we didn't make them just give them a HIPAA and make them subpoena them. We went and got the ER reports from the night of the accident. We got his GP, his general practitioner, every note. We got Dr. Inti from UCLA, his reports. And we got the, I apologize, I can't remember the neurologist that was in Lompoc that reviewed the reports and then did those neurologic reports. We included the exams. They had it all.
Let me, Mr. Grimes, if I could, back on the transportation cost issue. To the extent we don't have case law, statutes, or anything providing direction to the district courts about if you're going to decide this transportation cost issue, what type of factors should the court be considering? If you're coming up with that list, what should we include in those factors if we're to give direction to the district court?
It is my opinion that where children are concerned, these costs, because the day-to-day costs are supposed to be borne by child support, but these aren't day-to-day costs. They should be equally borne by each parent. So if a court is going to deviate from that, they have to make specific factors here. I will not disagree with opposing counsel with the questions that have been asked. I think the findings that were included in the order are inadequate, even though I may have a pretty good idea of what the intent was.
Right.
So here, I would say that Judge Forsberg needs to include in that order a finding that if mom is going to demand that it's going to be airfare to avoid all fights, etc., that cost should be borne by mom. Otherwise, meet in Victorville. Or if the parents, if she had paid her half of the cost previously, this wouldn't be there. But that was part of the issue. Okay? So that's why they originally went to Victorville. So that would be what I think has to be done. I think it needs to be, the district court must have the leeway to make specific findings that are specific to each child, the circumstances, and the conduct of the parent.
So under the regulation, under 425.150, the regulation allows modification of support based on the specific needs of the child and the economic circumstances of the parties. Do you think that allows the district court to look at conduct of the parent?
The needs of the child would, yes, Your Honor. In this case where a parent is found to have intentionally interfered to a limit and to create conflict, I absolutely do believe that a court can do something like that to eliminate the stress and the conflict that the child is seeing and therefore experiencing, as long as it relates back to the child. Okay, do I believe they should do it just because your ex is unhappy with you? No. It has to relate to the child. And I do think Judge Forsberg's findings, both in the findings of facts and in the transcript, are very clear that she's doing this because of the child. She expressed a specific concern about the stress this child was under, and that she believed it was because of the conflict of the parents, and she put most of that conflict onto the natural mother, the appellant in this case. My time is up. I apologize. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Willick.
First, I have to protest alleged new facts, which were just introduced, which are denied. There is no evidence or citations to the record for the things the counsel was talking about. There's not a single instance of interference. There's no, those facts don't exist. There's no scheduling of anything on dad's time. Yes, the findings were made.
But the findings are based on nothing. There's simply nothing in the record to substantiate them. I have the sites you're asking for. The quotation from the on the driver's license, it's from AA 1848-1849. Paul, all I have to say is it says Class C endorsement, non-restriction zero. Sorry, customized restrictions on the file, contact DMV. In terms of the schedule and whether the parties had an agreement, this is Dad's Exhibit C. It's on page 24 of the original fast track. It calls for equal division of winter break, alternating first and second half, and even in odd years, all 3-day weekends be in Las Vegas, 7 weeks in the summer. That's at AA 960 and 1039 through 1040. And Mom specifically agreed to every one of those points. Now, that would be an agreement. Well, I say that that's all the time I have, unless the court has any questions.
I don't think so. Thank you. Thanks, counsel. We appreciate your briefing and argument, the supplemental briefing, and additional information we got once we took the case up. So.